Welcome, everyone, to the February 9, 2012 meeting of the Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, and Economic Development. We've got a number of bills on the agenda. I will note for the record that we are not going to hear the transportation bills because many of the people who are concerned about that are off hearing or attending a service for former Oregon Transportation Commissioner Gail Ackerman today. So out of respect for them, we're not going to deal with that. We will take those up on Tuesday. So we're going to start off today with a public hearing on Senate Joint Memorial 201. We'll open the hearing on that, and let me see, who have I got here? Is Ralph Groner? Are you here, Ralph?
He was just right there.
He was.
He was, okay. Bill Cluding, Lee Hazelwood, Jim Geisinger, are you here? Jim's here, yeah. Short would be appreciated.
Okay. Chair Beyer and Vice Chair Atkinson and members of the committee, my name is Lee Hazelwood, a longtime senior advocate. Normally, I would be here talking about Oregon Project Independence that's helped save the state of Oregon millions of dollars. But I'm going to be talking about something that would save the state hundreds of millions of dollars. I'm here to support SJM 201-1. Let's use the Oregon Foreign Practice Act to manage the ONC railroads. Grantlands. This will restore the economic base for those affected counties. When I first moved to Oregon in 1978, it was exhilarating to see the timber and agriculture industry providing employment using renewable resources. Oregon was known as a vibrant contributor to our country. Over the next decade, environmental groups tied up the timber industry. The reduction in timber revenue started the long downhill spiral that put our schools and rural communities in trouble, especially in those areas with ONC lands. It just seems like yesterday, but it was December 2001, I testified in this very room on a timber-related issue. Oregon currently manages almost 800,000 acres of state timberlands capable of producing a very large, sustainable timber harvest each year. Yet many cities and counties in these areas are in serious financial trouble. Why not, instead of a sustainable harvest producing income, we allow special interest groups to tie the process up with court challenges? Instead of producing jobs and income for the state, we lose huge tracts each year to forest fires. A good example was the Biscuit Fire. Instead of logging fire-damaged timber, we let it rot. Even making it available for biomass use would have provided jobs and revenue. Using sustainable forest harvesting practice, we could generate hundreds of millions of dollars each year. I am in favor of SJM 201-1. Why? Because it would help provide stable school funding to our schools, emergency responsibles, senior disabled with sustainable forest management plan. Along with the plan comes a job which fuels the economic engine to improve our communities. In order for this state to regain its strength, we need to have timber production back as one of our financial cornerstones. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Atkinson, Committee for the Record, Bill Cluding, Carpenters and Joiners of America. I'm glad that you brought this bill forward. We've been needing this bill for almost 30 years. That's about how long I've worked on this issue. It just continually gets worse. The federal government has let this state down. They have also mismanaged these forests for the last 20-plus years. This pin I wear, ironically, 50,000 jobs. That's not quite what we lost since the mid-80s, just in the timber mills alone. Over 300 mills gone, most of them on these O&C lands. At one time, our counties were vibrant. The state was vibrant. Our industry was the one that, when we were at a semi-recession, our industry was the one that pulled the state out of it. We had the manpower, we had the revenue, but we're not there today. Even if the market was good right now, we couldn't really bring Oregon out of this hole we're in. This would be a start. If these counties lose this secure school funding, which I've been saying since 2007 it was going to end, well, we can see the handwriting on the wall today. It's going to end, and we have to have a backup plan. There's groups out there that they found out how the court systems work, and they've tied up everything now for 20-some years. And they're gearing up again to continue, even on our state lands as we talk today. I urge passage. My organization's in complete agreement with this. I like the amendment, and I wholly endorse it. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Jim?
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Atkinson, for the record, I'm Jim Geisinger with Associated Oregon Loggers. We're a trade group that represents almost 1,000 contract logging companies in Oregon and businesses associated with our industry. I'd like to start by thanking Senator Girard and Senator Atkinson for introducing this joint memorial and for the Dash 1 amendments as well. I think everybody knows over 60% of the forest lands in Oregon is owned by the federal government, and it's not often that the state legislature has an opportunity to weigh in and provide some guidance on how those lands should be managed. This joint memorial provides the means to do just that. The federal forest lands in Oregon used to provide about half the timber that our industry consumed year in and year out on a sustainable basis. Today, those lands produce less than 10% of what we use. There's huge room for improvement. With the decline in timber harvest has also come the decline in revenue to the counties that in this case used to share 50% of the revenue produced from the O&C lands. For the last 20 years, those funds have been replaced by direct federal subsidies that have now come to an end. Consequently, the situation the counties find themselves in is more severe, more critical than anything I've seen in the 35 years that I've been involved in this industry. And as severe as the problem is, it is so simple to fix. And the way to do that is to reconnect revenue to our counties to the management of the forest lands that lie in those counties. And that's what the bill that will eventually be introduced by Congressman Walden, DeFazio, and Schrader will do. It's a very modest proposal. It would manage about half of the lands for timber production and provide some certainty to the counties and to our industry that that timber would in fact be sold and be made available. But it requires legislative action to become a reality. As Mr. Cluding's pointed out, for the last 2 decades, every attempt that our federal government has made to actively manage the resource has been stymied in court. I think Congress needs to make it clear its intentions as to how it wants these lands managed, and that's what the legislation does, and that's what this memorial supports. And I can't help but find that there might be some collateral benefits to this that this committee might be interested in, because if the BLM did in fact start selling timber again, the demand for tugboats in Coos Bay would go through the roof, and it would solve a whole bunch of problems that you guys have. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have, and I encourage you to support this joint memorial. And Senator Girard, Senator Atkinson, thank you very much for your sponsorship of it.
Thank you, Jim. I would note that in Mr. Hayward's, I think it's your packet here, yeah, Lee, that most of this dark area you have of closed mills happens to be in my district. We used to say Springfield was a timber town. Now we don't have a hell of a lot of
Senator Beyer, I realize how important they were in your district.
Put me through college. Thank you, gentlemen. Oops, I'm sorry. Mr. Atkinson. Senator Atkinson, excuse me.
Mr. Hazelwood.
Sit down.
Just a quick signpost. Jim and Bill, thank you for your testimony and thank you for your support on the bill. But there's a big audience out there that's very in tune with business issues and some natural resource issues, but there's a whole bunch of people in this audience that have no idea of the impact that Mr. Hazelwood has had on this building for all the years he's lobbied. And I think it's very important that Mr. Hazelwood be recognized publicly from a business committee that you usually don't come to a bunch of different generations of lobbyists and professionals back there who don't know who you are, to say that if you really want a lesson on how to have your entire heart involved in public service and in lobbying, some of you younger folks should sit up and buy Mr. Hazelwood a cup of coffee, because Mr. Hazelwood is the real deal, and he is the standard by which I judge a lot of things, one of which is OPI. So I hope I'm embarrassing you fully, but I'm giving you the honor that you deserve, sir, and thank you for coming on this bill. This is not your area, but I want you to know and the audience of business people out there to know that there are people like you in this building.
Thank you. I didn't know whether to care a potential conflict of interest now because my first name is Lee, similar to Senator Beyer, but I'm declaring that now. Thank you.
Mr. Hazelwood has been giving me a bad time for 20 years.
Thank you.
But I appreciate it. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Mr. Groner and Ivan Maluski. Ivan, are you around?
Dave.
Come on, Ralph.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Ralph Groner, here today to support Senate Joint Memorial 201-1. Mine will be quick because I was testifying next door. My difference with those who don't want to see counties managed, I did a research project and I left it in my car, but I can remember the keys. Three of my counties, Coos County, have county forest, Clackamas County, my county, meaning my members, have county forest, and Hood River County, one of my counties, has county forest. I therefore wanted to compare the production, the efficiency, and how they treated those forests compared to BLM, and that's what I did. Bottom line, we're efficient. Hood River meant over $3 million a year into their general fund. Clackamas County, only $750,000, but it helps fund their county parks, and into the general county fund of Coos County was $3 million a year. My suggestion is for those who think somehow turning management over to counties is going to be some kind of desperate take back and cutting of trees that shouldn't be cut or ruining the environment, sustained yield has been followed by all county forests, and I'm proud to say I helped found Clackamas County Forest as a commissioner in 1975. So I appreciate your consideration of this issue. Thank you for bringing the bill forward. I wholeheartedly support it. I think the management compared to BLM is 100 times as efficient, and it would bring the money in, by the way, counties desperately need by the short change of the loss of forest revenue as well as Measure 50. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Groner. Ivan?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ivan Maluski. I'm the Conservation Director for the Oregon Chapter of the Sierra Club. We respectfully urge your opposition to Senate Joint Memorial 201 today. We believe this memorial represents a one-sided and frankly misguided approach to resolving the ONC County funding issue, focused on an unrealistic outcome of the federal government giving away over 2 million acres of federal land for an uncertain future under local management. The Dash 1 amendment supports a bill in Congress that has not yet been introduced, and we would urge you not to endorse a bill whose final language and implications are still unknown. In past legislative sessions, this body has passed memorials urging an extension of secure rural schools payments. The Sierra Club supports that supports legislation currently in Congress in both the U.S. House and U.S. Senate to extend these payments, and we're working towards that end in Washington, D.C. We would urge the legislature to once again do the same rather than spending time focused on a memorial in support of federal land management changes that stand little likelihood of passing into federal law. Passing this memorial in lieu of passing a memorial in support of extending secure rural schools payments sends a terrible message to Congress that the Oregon legislature would prefer an unrealistic solution of local control over federal lands rather than a continued, predictable, stable funding from the government. We cannot afford to send Congress mixed messages on this issue. Further, we believe this memorial is a distraction from tangible activities the legislature could and should be taking to assist counties that have responded slowly to the impending expiration of this current round of county payments. Some of the actions the legislature could take, but certainly not all, are reflected in identified in the shared responsibility proposal put forward recently by a group of Oregon conservation organizations. We've provided you copies of that proposal. Under the shared responsibility approach, each level of government, federal, state, and county, would be responsible for covering one-third of the current gap in funding created by the expiration of county payments. The state's share, which I'll focus on here, could come from a small increase in the state's forest products harvest tax, in part to capture a sliver of the revenue associated with the boom in whole raw log exports from private industrial forest land in Oregon in recent years. In 2010 alone, nearly $700 million worth of whole raw logs were exported from Oregon and Washington ports, with Oregon garnering just $3.75 per thousand board feet for wood valued at roughly $500 per thousand board feet. Raw log exports from Oregon over the past few years have in fact exceeded the timber volume coming from federal lands. Rather than seeing this export boom as a potential source of revenue, the Oregon legislature actually reduced the forest products harvest tax in 2009. With price premiums associated with the export market, even quadrupling the current forest products harvest tax would result in a less than 3% tax of the value of raw logs being sent overseas. This would create a new source of revenue to help stabilize county budgets, would have little financial impact on raw log exporters, and could even help incentivize domestic mills if coupled with proactive efforts by the legislature to rebate some of the tax increase for domestic milling. Legislature could further act this session to provide counties with greater flexibility on how they can use existing restricted funds they have from past rounds of county payments. For the federal share, we believe that administrative savings could be realized through transferring BLM ownership to the Forest Service. This would involve the layoff of some federal employees, which some on the committee may support. And we also fundamentally disagree with the premise that ONC lands are currently releasing greenhouse gases. If anything, the opposite is true. The result of the Northwest Forest Plan in 1994 has protected forests, allowed forests to grow older, sequester more carbon. If anything, forest fires should be considered to be carbon neutral if they're allowed to grow back. Further, we believe that that per Congress's funding of ONC land management, the BLM is actually doing a pretty good job, meaning it's congressionally approved allowable sale quantities. They're actually meeting roughly 90% of what Congress has funded them to do. But they're only about 10% of the Northwest Forest Plan. These lands, these Western Oregon BLM lands, provide roughly 25% of the timber coming under this plan. Additionally, the lack of domestic demand for lumber has been a far bigger factor in the viability of federal forest timber sales in recent years than environmental restrictions designed to protect clean water and endangered species that were implemented over 20 years ago. In fact, it was not that long ago that Congressman DeFazio introduced legislation to help buy back BLM timber sales because the prices had changed so dramatically. Lastly, for the county share, we have pointed out that there are tools that counties have available to fill some of these gaps, including minor adjustments to local property tax rates. Some of the counties most affected have some of the lowest property tax in the Oregon, if not the entire nation. Nonetheless, if there's an element of local control that we would support, it would be that local counties have the control for what their tax rates should be. However, under a shared responsibility approach as I've outlined, if counties, county voters or county commissioners are not interested in supporting local tax adjustments, the impacts would be less severe. So I appreciate the opportunity to testify on this today. We would urge you to focus on more tangible and realistic legislative action to help stabilize funding in Oregon's ONC counties. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ivan. Mr. Barrels? Is there anybody else who feels the need to testify on this bill? That's all I have on the list. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Dave Barrels, representing the Association of ONC Counties. And it's been my honor to work with this group for more than 45 years. Through good times and not so good times that we're seeing today. I want to thank Senator Giron and Senator Atkinson for, especially Senator Giron, who I spent more time with him than he probably wanted to, working on the Dash 1 amendments. We are very supportive of the Dash 1 amendments and would appreciate the committee adopting those. And I just, that really concludes what I was going to say, Mr. Chairman, but except I cannot resist the opportunity. The preceding speaker, Mr. Chairman, represents an organization whose official position has been, and to my knowledge may still be, that not one tree should be cut on any public lands. Not one tree. Not county, not state, not federal. And for him to say that the current allowable cut, which is 10% of what we used to do on a sustained yield basis, is a great thing, is just a slap, I think, to rural America, and it can't go unchallenged. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Barrels. Last chance. Anybody else feel a need to talk? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on SJM 201 and move to, just momentarily, going to move to Senate Bill 1556. We'll open the public hearing. Patrick, Senator Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1556 permits contracting agencies to give preference to a bidder or proposer that exceeds the federal Buy America requirements that apply to federally funded transit projects. The measure has an emergency clause, would take effect upon passage. We have received a no revenue impact for this measure, but the fiscal impact is still in progress, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Mona Sanderson. I'm here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 1556. You know that the public is saying we really need more jobs. Please create jobs. It's very difficult, I think, for the legislature to create jobs. But this bill will actually help. It, if passed, it has the potential of creating hundreds of manufacturing jobs. And I like this because manufacturing jobs are important to our local and national economies. They pay more on benefits and wages, and therefore I hope that you will take this bill very seriously. Basically, what it does, it has a very narrow focus. It relates only to transit agencies, and we have at least six public transit agencies: TriMet, Lane Transit, Salem-Keizer Transit, Rogue Valley Transit, Bend Area Transit, and Corvallis Transit Systems. And it relates to the transit agencies and their purchase of rolling stock. And I didn't even know what rolling stock was, but it is buses, vans, cars, rail cars, locomotives, trolley cars, and buses, and ferry boats. I talked with Oregon employers like Clackamas-based United Streetcar, Oregon Ironworks, and they are very interested in this bill. They are the only modern streetcar company located in the United States and the first in the country to manufacture a Buy America compliant streetcar. Again, I didn't know a whole lot about Buy America, and this is a very common sense change, and it's going to help grow our companies right here in the state of Oregon. Because of federal rules, if an agency wishes to give a preference to a bidder whose vehicle has more than U.S.-made content than required by federal standards, and right now it is required by federal standard that you must have, an agency has to, or the bidder, the contractor, has to have 60% of its parts be made from U.S. made. The quirk in this law is if they want to something more than 60% of that standard, they are not able to do that unless the state passes statute like this one. So this is Senate Bill 1556 is a very permissive bill. It doesn't impose new standards. On the contrary, it actually gives Oregon's communities greater control over the public resources that are spent. And it will provide these transit agencies with the opportunity to contribute further toward the creation and ongoing sustainability of good, well-paying jobs in Oregon. I talked with the president of United Streetcar, and you should have a letter in your packet by them on why they feel this would be an extremely important bill for them. I also talked with Mills Innovations. The CEO, Dan Mills, stated they're located in Junction City, and they let me know that their work with United Streetcar is revitalizing their previously struggling business. We really do need the communities really do need the opportunity to invest more of their public transit funds in American jobs as they see fit. And they are not able to go above that 60% federal standard unless we pass this law. And it's very permissive. If the transit agencies would like to use federal funds higher than the federal standard, then this is the bill that we need to pass so we can give these transit agencies the ability to do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. To be clear, so this is permissive legislation. It's not a new requirement.
It is not a mandate. It's permissive.
Questions of the Senator? Thank you very much. Well, let's get back to your work. I only have two people signed up on this, Caitlin and Alana. If you'd like to testify now, we'll get it out of the way.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, Caitlin Soss here today representing Chandra Brown, president of United Streetcar. We'd like to thank the senator for her support on this legislation, her leadership. Unfortunately, she took most of my talking points, but to reemphasize what she's already said, we were the first manufacturer of the Buy American compliant streetcar, which has helped create 133 jobs at United Streetcar. We have also started manufacturing the City of Tucson's order for 7 streetcars, which will help create 873 jobs at United Streetcar. This legislation really follows in the footsteps of what other states have done, such as California, to increase domestic manufacturing in their state and help create jobs. And we really just urge the committee to pass this bill and also look at other legislation that will help increase domestic manufacturing.
Thank you. Alana?
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. Ilana Guinea with the Oregon AFL-CIO. You know, this bill follows on the work that you all did on the very popular HB 3000 last session that allowed local governments and the state government to purchase American-made products and Oregon-made products, notwithstanding the lowest bid contract provisions that we have. This applies that same concept to spending where we're receiving federal dollars on transportation vehicles. Same concept, but we've got to pass this bill to be able to take advantage of the federal exception that allows us to purchase goods that have a higher content than the minimum required. This does not only affect United Streetcar and their suppliers. There are other manufacturers in Oregon who would benefit from this bill. Some of the manufacturers in the supply chain for Freightliner actually produce goods that are used on buses as well. There's a lot of jobs resting on this bill, both in Oregon and across the U.S. Other states have done this, and our employers are benefiting from it. We hope that you will as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 1556? Well, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1556. We do not have fiscals on it yet, so we can't act, so we'll have to wait for that for another day. We're going to open a work session on SJM 201. Senator Atkinson.
Move the -1 amendments to Senate Bill.
Senator Atkinson has moved the -1 amendments to Joint Senate Memorial 201. Questions on that? Is there any opposition to the amendment? There is none. The amendment is adopted. Senator.
I move the memorial as amended with the do adopt recommendation of the floor.
Senator Atkinson has moved SJM 201 to the Senate floor with a do adopt recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, is there any objection? Senate Bill 201 is moved to the floor with a do adopt recommendation. Senator Girod will carry.
Can I do that jointly with Senator Atkinson?
You certainly can. Senator Atkinson and Senator Girod will jointly carry this, and we are closed on that. We will now open a work session on Senate Bill 1546. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1546 is a measure that we heard first a week ago today. It's the one that provides an exemption from ODOT from the need to obtain a local permit prior to removing trees. Permits the department to inspect and condemn trees that pose a potential immediate and substantial risk of damage or injury by obstructing, hanging over, otherwise encroaching on, or threatening to encroach on in any manner on a state highway. It increases the amount of the minimum appraised value of forest products required for the Department of Transportation to place the forest products for sale at public auction. We have already adopted, Mr. Chair, the Dash 1 Amendment. We adopted that on the 2nd. That amendment specifies the state forester need consult with the Department of Transportation only at the request of the department. It clarifies that consultation need only occur regarding reforestation in areas within or adjacent to a state highway right-of-way. There's no fiscal and no revenue impact to the measure with the Dash 1s. As I said, we've already adopted those amendments. So all we need to do is decide on whether to move the bill forward, Mr. Chair.
Senator Atkinson.
I would move Senate Bill 1546 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Atkinson has moved Senate Bill 1546 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion of the motion. Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, Senate Bill 1546 is moved to the floor with the due pass recommendation and the work session is closed. Senator Johnson will carry. Let's see here. Okay, now we're going to do taxis. So we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1588. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1588 excludes from the definition of employment for purposes of unemployment insurance benefits services performed in operation of passenger motor vehicles operated as taxi cabs or for non-emergency medical transportation by a person with ownership or leasehold interest in a vehicle for certain entities operated by the Board of Owner-Operators that are elected by members of the entity. The measure has an effective date of the 91st day following sine die. I believe, Mr. Chair, that we have received only some of the impact statements for this measure. We are currently waiting on, we have received the fiscal impact statement, Mr. Chair, but are still waiting on the revenue impact statement. And I'm told by the Legislative Revenue Office that they are watching this hearing to help inform them before making the revenue impact statement.
How wonderful!
Yes, we have received what is an indeterminate fiscal impact on the measure.
Mr. Campbell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Darren Campbell. I live in Portland, Oregon, and here today representing Radio Cab Company. Along with representing Radio Cab's legislative needs, I'm also an owner and operator at Radio Cab. We have operated in Portland since 1946 and are currently one of the largest cab companies in the state of Oregon. Radio Cab owner-operators own 100% of the shares in our corporation, in addition to the vehicles we drive. Currently, Radio Cab has approximately 160 owner-operators and about 300 lease drivers, all acting as independent businesses. In recent years, Radio Cab has come under fire from the Employment Division Audits Department. Auditors came to Radio Cab last year digging through our records to come to the conclusion that our drivers were operating as employees and that the company owed the state nearly $360,000. Radio Cab has always operated with drivers that act as independent contractors. Our drivers work the hours they want, accept the orders they want, and work the areas they want to work. The owners, such as me, are responsible for all the maintenance and upkeep of our vehicles. The City of Portland recognizes each driver as their own business, where if we make over a certain amount, we are required to pay City of Portland business taxes. Senate Bill 1588 would exempt certain cab drivers from employee status for the purposes of unemployment compensation. Taxi drivers are not eligible to receive unemployment compensation, even though some have tried. To my knowledge, none of the drivers that have filed for unemployment compensation have been accepted. I'll just say that's to my knowledge. I don't know if any actually have or not. If this legislation does not pass, we will have to completely change the way we operate as an industry. Costs to the drivers will increase significantly, and we would be forced to work certain areas accept orders regardless of if we want them or not, and we would have to take scheduled lunch and breaks. We would lose our freedoms that many of us love about this work. Our ability to prosper and grow our own clientele will suffer. The costs that would be burdened on us would be great enough that I believe many drivers may not be able to make ends meet. These freedoms are the ones that make our industry competitive and customer service friendly. I would ask that you pass Senate Bill 1588 to the floor unamended and with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Cameron. My understanding, use the term owner-operator, my understanding is that, in essence, Radio Cab is a co-op?
It is set up like a co-op, correct.
Okay, so we, this would only apply to operations such as that?
Correct.
So it's fairly narrow, and I believe I've been told that probably they qualify under law as independent operators now in that situation, and you're just trying to clarify that.
Correct. This is a bill of clarification.
Okay. Other questions? Mr. Campbell.
A housekeeping bill, correct?
Well, I'm not sure I'd call it that, but close, Senator Starr. No other questions. Thank you, Mr. Campbell.
Thank you.
I have three other people who have look like Rob Edwards, Dave. What do you think? Dave's coming up, and Steve Lanning.
Always default to having them say their name. Always good to default to having them say their name.
Yeah. You all signed up as neutral on the bill, but still felt the need to testify. Go ahead, please. Whoever wants to go first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rob Edwards. I'm the Deputy Administrator for the Unemployment Insurance Division Tax. We're here just to talk a little bit about Senate Bill 1588. The basic framework for unemployment insurance tax is that all payments for services are subject to the tax and are available to be used as a basis for benefits unless there's a specific exclusion in law. Senate Bill 1588 creates such an exclusion. We do concur that it is a very narrow exclusion. Will have an effect on probably, as it stands now, not more than one business in the state. It does have the necessary conforming language in it, so there won't be any problem with federal unemployment laws, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, so was my characterization correct? What they're trying to do is essentially the owner-operator in sort of a co-op form?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions, Rob? Seeing none, whoever wants to go next?
David Gerstenfeld, the Unemployment Insurance Division Administrator, and I'm just available to answer questions, so I'll happily not take up
any questions. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Steve Lanning with the Oregon AFL-CIO, and we're neutral on the bill, but we feel like we needed to come forward because last session there was a much broader bill, and we opposed that bill. And we don't oppose this one. We're neutral on it. And generally, we oppose erosion of UI benefits, but we don't view this exception as an erosion of benefits. This group has long acted as independent contractors, we believe, and because it's narrow and because of the nature of their group as owner-operators, we believe that this is okay. Thanks.
I'm not sure they're independent contractors. It seems like they're owners of the business. Okay. Any questions to this panel? Thank you very much. That's all I have signed up to testify on this. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? If not, I do not believe that we have the have the revenue. Hopefully the revenue analysts have watched this and they're now informed and can issue a revenue statement. So we will close on public hearing on Senate Bill 1588. And we're going to be in recess just for a second here, waiting for Senator Whitsitt on Senate Bill 1533. And after that, we're going 1501.
That should be fun.
Senator Whitsitt, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, committee members.
For the record, my name is Doug Whitsett. I represent Senate District 28. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 1533. As introduced, Senate Bill 1533 is exactly the same bill as the A.N. Gross version of Senate Bill 586 that passed this committee last year unanimously and passed the Senate floor 28-1. The bill failed in the House committee, yeah, I understand, because Chair Hobley believed that the expansion of the eligible renewable energy sources was too broad. We worked in the interim, and the Dash 2 amendments before you are an agreement between Representative Hobley and myself as to how to move forward with the bill. It narrows the eligibility to solar and geothermal energy sources only. ORS 279.527 and 528 require that 1.5% of the cost of all new public buildings be expended on solar energy utilization. That requirement extends to buildings that are expanded by remodeling by more than 50%. What brought this forward is the Lake County Hospital was undergoing expansion. They brought in geothermal heat, piped it in from a nearby well. Their entire HVAC system is run by geothermal, yet the current law required them to spend over $250,000 on solar. This is not an isolated situation in Southern Oregon. Five of the seven geothermal resource centers in Oregon are located in Klamath and Lake counties. So with Senate Bill 1533 with a Dash 2 amendment, allows either solar or geothermal energy resources to be used to satisfy the 1.5% requirement that is currently in law. So I would ask you to please adopt the Dash 2 amendments and then move Senate Bill 1533 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you. I'll be willing to answer questions.
Thank you. We have no one else to speak. Well, Patrick, do we have anybody else?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This is good cardio today, Mr. Chair.
Is there anybody else who wishes to, or excuse me, start over? Do you have any questions? Yes, Senator.
Very quickly, Senator Whitsett. Mr. Chair. Senator Whitsett, thank you for bringing this forward again. Thank you for the amendment. So just to clarify, the difference between this version and last session is that you've narrowed it from being any renewable energy to geothermal. They're adding geothermal to what was already a solar requirement.
Yes, okay. Under the same terms.
Thank you.
Okay, anybody else? Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
I think we
Thank
can adopt much. The amendments today, but we couldn't move the bill. We don't have fiscal.
Thank you.
Glenn Montgomery and Jeff Bissonnette. Mr. Bissonnette, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, here representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. I've signed up as neutral, but felt compelled to testify on my neutrality. Basically, I have no strong feelings about putting geothermal in. The original bill and the current statute was to give solar a shot in the arm. I think that is still good state policy. I think that the application of geothermal energy around the state is narrow enough that it doesn't have a significant impact on sort of the solar impact on the application of solar. There are folks that probably disagree with that, and you'll hear from one soon. I guess I just wanted to testify that and the testimony from Senator Whitsett actually puts my mind even more at ease is that when we talk about geothermal electric generation and direct use of geothermal energy, that we're not just talking about heat pumps, that you know we go to Lowe's and buy and that sort of thing, that we are really talking about you know a geothermal energy system that we're trying to hook up to. And again, I think the application that Senator Whitsett just testified to is kind of what I had in mind, and so I just wanted to clarify that for the record. And if it, I would have opposed a broader application. I would oppose heat pumps, but I do not oppose, and CUB does not oppose, the inclusion of geothermal electric generation because it is relatively limited and still, I think, gives solar a shot in the arm. Thank you very much. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Jeff? Thank you. Mr. Montgomery?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Glenn Montgomery. I'm the executive director of Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association, which is the trade group that's been around for 30 years, supporting everyone from a sole proprietor to a manufacturer such as Solar World, PV Powered, and Bend. For the record, I'm not opposed to any renewable energy technology or energy efficiency technology, but I am opposed to Senate Bill 1533 for several reasons. When the original statute was enacted, the intent behind that was to, it was a very strategic intent to promote solar, the solar industry in Oregon. And we did so by attracting manufacturers here. We did so by incenting the deployment of the technology. And I think the spirit of that bill has yet to really be played out since it was enacted. We haven't had a whole heck of a lot of construction in the public building process that have fallen under this act, and we've really not taken full advantage of that. So opening it up to additional technologies was something that we felt was premature. In addition, since 2009 when we capped the Betsy, in 2011 when we dismantled the Betsy, the commercial solar industry, of which these public buildings would fall under, has declined, and we've lost many jobs. Large developers have moved out of the state. Some of our homegrown businesses are struggling to survive in the commercial sector. So again, I agree with Jeff that the intent was to give a shot in the arm to solar. Commercial has struggled for the last 3 years and has actually declined from last year to the year before. So again, opening this up to other technologies, and I was not privy to the latest amendment that we had here, but opening it up further dilutes the intent of the original statute and is another nail in the coffin for commercial solar. I would also suggest that solar energy is a ubiquitous resource. It's available everywhere. When we start opening it up to new technologies, geothermal is a fine resource. It is geographically located and limited as such. My concern is both the additive nature of what we're trying to incent here. A district heating system, as an example, or some type of energy efficiency where geothermal might be deployed, is already, for one, provided there are incentives provided for conservation that could apply. There are also just the simple economics of some of these systems. They make good business in the first place. And I would like to see that we are actually adding to renewable energy capacity, not merely supplanting it with some other technology that, in fact, some of our current standards are requiring. So, you know, I'd like to look more closely at what we're suggesting when we say geothermal technology. Jeff mentioned heat pumps. You know, we need to see what that entails, and also whether or not we are truly being additive or we're being mutually exclusive in terms of one over the other. And if there is to be a compromise, I would suggest that the economic case be made for geothermal, that it actually is a better use of public dollars than solar. I think solar ought to be the preference because that's what the bill was designed to incent. If someone can make a case that there is another technology that is better suited, let them make that case, but I think solar needs to come first. I appreciate your consideration. I'm willing to answer
questions. You could argue that for a long time, but we won't today. Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really briefly to Glenn's comments, the case that you've presented is, and the fact that I have a major solar contractor in my district that employs a number of people, the case that you've made is why I was the single no vote in the Senate last session, but the amendments narrow it significantly. I mean, it's just geothermal, and that's, I mean, I think that's just realistically not going to be, you know, it's not going to be the death of the solar panel installation industry. But I do want to echo what Glenn has said. In talking with my constituents that do this work, they said once Once the changes were made to the Betsy, our work just dried up, and this public requirement is about all they have left going. So,
exactly.
Anyone else? Thank you both. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 1533? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1533, and we will open the work session for the amendment.
Move the -2 amendment to the bill.
Senator Atkins has moved the -2 amendment to Senate Bill 1533. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the -2s are adopted, and since we don't have the fiscal, we will
be busy on Tuesday.
Huh?
We will be busy on Tuesday.
We will wait. So we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1533. That one's there. And now we're to the main event. We will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1501. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1501 creates a central warehouse license to authorize licensees to store wine at a central warehouse for transport to premises in which the licensee holds a qualifying interest. The measure authorizes the holder of an off-premises sales license to store wine at a licensed premises for transport to other licensed premises for sale at retail under certain conditions. It authorizes the sale of wine transported to receiving premises on behalf of a transporting holder. It authorizes the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to issue a central warehouse license to cooperatives composed of at least 10 members, all of whom hold an off-premise sales license. The measure has an emergency clause, would take effect upon passage. I believe we handed out right at the start of the meeting the fiscal impact statement for this measure. So it should be in front of you. If it's not, we will get you a copy. It's probably in your pile somewhere. This measure does have a referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, so the fiscal impact bolsters that subscore for, I believe, Mr. Chair.
And a whole lot of narrative to come to the end of saying we don't know.
They were very talkative.
Senator Johnson, would you like to testify? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I have the privilege of representing Senate District 16 in Northwest Oregon. My main interest in this bill is that it's about jobs. At a time when Oregon is simply desperate for jobs, we have the opportunity to preserve 1,000 jobs and create another 600 more. And I have the communities in which Grocery Outlet, that would be one of the companies affected by this bill, plans to build stores if we can settle the central warehouse housing debate. And I think it would be important to read it into the record just so that people have a sense of the scope of where there would either be rehabilitation of older buildings or construction of new stick buildings. And I will do that. Tualatin, Alloa, Forest Grove, Canby, downtown Portland, the Lloyd District, Hood River, Hermiston, Pendleton, Baker City, Burns, Lapine, Salem, Ashland, Medford, Newport, Tillamook, may I say that again? Tillamook, Astoria, may I say that again? Astoria, Cottage Grove, Woodburn, Madras, and Lebanon. I represent those two communities with the extra emphasis, and any jobs in those communities would be at this point a gift from God. This is an opportunity to create those jobs, both the construction jobs and the clerks that will stay on to do the work in those new facilities. It is also virtually the same bill that came to you last session as Senate Bill 438. Very little has changed. It represents a willingness on the part of the receiving central warehouse folks, the grocery industry, to pay fees to help offset the administration of the bill. It is a chance for us to have stores, going back to the economic development angle of this, stores in places that I think the new nomenclature is food deserts, places where it's cheaper to go down and buy something greasy and horrible from the local greasy horrible place than it is to be able to get to a grocery store. One of the beauties of the grocery stores that we're talking about, the new construction of Grocery Outlet, is that those are new grocery stores in places not typically served. So that really is my argument for why this committee should favorably consider this bill. I think this is a wonderful opportunity to have this session be a true jobs bill, and I would respectfully request your favorable consideration of the bill before you.
Thank you, Senator. Questions to Senator Johnson? Seeing none, we'll let you get back to Ways and Means.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Okay, let's see. We have some for and against. Let's just start out with the panel of the proponents. Mr. DiLorenzo, Oxley, and Miller. You want to start this out? John, if I could ask you, is describe first how much, where does this bill differ from the one that this committee dealt with in the last session?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm an attorney at the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, and I'm here on behalf of my client, Grocery Outlet, Inc. Mr. Chair, the bill departs from Senate Bill 438A, which your committee approved unanimously last session, in two respects. First of all, 438A allowed central warehouses to accept wine from distributors and from in-state wineries. When the distributors brought to our attention the potential that there could be a constitutional violation by not allowing out-of-state wineries to also ship to the warehouses, we corrected that in this bill before you. So this bill will allow central warehouses to receive wine from distributors, in-state wineries, and out-of-state wineries. The second change in the bill is that the central warehouse licensees will pay a fee of $1,000 per year, which is four times the fee which distributors pay annually. And those are the only changes to the bill.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I began my representation of Grocery Outlet in December 2007 when the Oregon Liquor Control Commission made an about-face of a 20-year policy and informed my client that it could no longer receive shipments of wine from distributors at its own warehouse in Clackamas County and reship the wine to grocery outlet stores it owned throughout the state. That model, which had been approved by the OSCC since 1986, has been responsible for much of our growth from a very few stores to 35 throughout the state of Oregon. Only after intervention of a circuit court and a formal injunction against the Liquor Control Commission have we been able to continue our business in this state. Our stores are located near every major Oregon town. We serve over 500,000 Oregonians per month, especially Oregonians who are in need of food at very inexpensive prices. For more than 25 years, Grocery Outlet has used its Clackamas facility to receive and store wine. Between 1986 and 2007, both the Liquor Commission and the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association took various positions concerning whether this practice, known as central warehousing, is permissible under Oregon law. In May 2007, the OLCC contacted my client about the practice of central warehousing at its Clackamas warehouse and confirmed that a letter it had issued in 1986 in fact authorized the storage of wine at the warehouse. That letter was at tab 2 of the reference book, which we used last session in support of Senate Bill 438. And I have brought extra copies of that. You don't have them, but if you would like to have access to them, I've got some extra copies for you. In addition, as recently as February 2007, counsel for the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association made clear that, quote, there is no ban on central warehousing of wine in Oregon. It has been going on forever. There is a ban on central warehousing of beer. It has to be delivered to a licensed premises, unquote. That statement can be found at tab 4 of the reference book. In December 2007, at the urging of the beer and wine distributors, the OLCC disclaimed its 1986 letter and informed us that the practice of central warehousing would no longer be permitted. When all extensions ran out, we took the OLCC to court. On July 25, 2008, Judge Stephen Maurer of the Clackamas County Circuit Court issued an injunction expressly prohibiting the commission from taking any adverse action against Grocery Outlet based on its new position concerning central warehousing. Following the injunction, administrative proceedings commenced at the commission. On October 20, 2009, Administrative Law Judge Allison Webster issued a 16-page opinion and proposed order in favor of Grocery Outlet and in support of central warehousing. Judge Webster's proposed order, which is at tab 7 of your documents, stated the grocery outlet was authorized to continue its business of receiving and storing wine from its Clackamas warehouse and delivering it to grocery outlet retail stores throughout the state for sale to the general public. However, at its April 2010 meeting, the Liquor Commission, by a bare 3-2 vote, again at the urging of the distributors, voted to overturn Judge Webster's decision and issued a final order against grocery outlet. On June 17, 2010, while still protected by the injunction, grocery outlet filed its appeal in the Court of Appeals. That appellate case is still pending. Whoever loses that case will certainly seek review in the Oregon Supreme Court. And so it is my view that a final judicial resolution of this issue is at least a year plus away. Senate Bill 1501 is almost identical to Senate Bill 438, which you voted for unanimously last session, and I indicated in what respects earlier. The bill still retains the OLCC's recommended 10-store threshold for maintaining central warehouses. That was the OLCC's recommendation. However, any licensed retailer retains the right to store its own wine at its stores for shipment to its other stores, and it doesn't matter how many stores they have. Also, any licensed retailer is free to join a cooperative, like Unified Grocers, to take advantage of central warehousing. Senate Bill 1501 also provides for the license fee, which I mentioned. Mr. Chair, members, there are no policy reasons why retailers should not be able to utilize central warehouses for their own inventory to keep prices affordable to the consuming public. The distributors have argued that the legislature should not weigh in on this controversy, first of all, because the matter is currently being litigated by the courts. There are two reasons why the committee should give no weight to that argument. First, the bill applies to all retailers, none of which, other than Grocery Outlet, are parties to the litigation. Second, Grocery Outlet currently sustains and supports over 1,000 jobs, as Senator Johnson mentioned, and it is only Judge Maher's injunction that continues to preserve those 1,000-plus jobs today. If the distributors ultimately get their way, many of those jobs will go away. Many of you know that Grocery Outlet is interested in expanding its operations in Oregon. The consumer need for lower-priced products is certainly present in many parts of our state. Our contemplated expansion of 20 or more stores should create an additional 600-plus jobs. Without Senate Bill 1501, Grocery Outlet must depend upon ultimately winning in the Court of Appeals and potentially in the Supreme Court. However, if the bill is enacted, your actions will not only secure the 1,000 jobs, but will provide security to our financiers to provide them the predictability that will allow them to help finance our expansion. The distributors have also invoked the specter of the three-tier system as a justification for prohibiting central warehousing in general. Now, the three-tier system, which was adopted following the repeal of prohibition at the urging of John D. Rockefeller, was designed to separate manufacturers from distributors and from retailers. The historic rationale that prompted many states to enact the three-tier system was twofold. First, states wanted to prevent the proliferation of single-brand saloons on major streets that was occurring pre-prohibition, because those saloons were selling but one brand. Second, the three-tier system at the time was designed to break the hold of organized crime over the networks which had been established by bootleggers during prohibition. Of course, those concerns no longer have any modern-day applicability. Instead, the three-tier system has evolved to create a preferred position for distributors, which permits them to essentially charge tribute instead of fees for value added, and only embeds more cost into the price paid by the end consumer. Retailers value distributors and are more than happy to pay when they deliver value added. But retailers should not have to pay distributors every time retailers wish to move their product from one of their locations to another location. Not only is the three-tier system an anachronism today, it is so riddled with exceptions that the exceptions virtually swallow the rule. I have provided you a copy of ORS 471.001 through 402 as a supplemental exhibit. And I've highlighted in yellow those statutes or the portions thereof that constitute the three-tier system. I have, however, highlighted in pink the exceptions to the three-tier system. As you can tell from perusing those pages,
The exceptions are so significant, they do in fact swallow the rule. Today, the three-tier system can be fairly summarized as follows. Manufacturers may not act as wholesalers, which is the given name given to distributors, or to retailers. Wholesalers and distributors may not act as manufacturers or retailers, and retailers may not act as manufacturers or wholesaler distributors unless you make homemade beer, or unless you're a cruise ship, or unless you are a brewery public house, or unless you have a brewery license and sell beverages to the public for consumption on your premises, or unless you have a winery license and sell wine directly to consumers for consumption on your premises, or unless you're a distillery and permit tastings of your distilled liquor on your premises, or unless you're a wholesaler who sells no more than 55 gallons at one time of wine to consumers for consumption at your licensed premises, and the list goes on and on and on. That, members of the committee, is the current state of the so-called three-tier system. And although some may view this mishmash of rules as a holy grail, Judge Maurer's comments were quite telling. When asked why the state would suffer harm if the court enjoined the commission from trying to enforce its about-face and grocery outlets operation, the commission said that doing so would harm the state because it would offend the three-tier system. In response, His Honor said at tab 5 of your materials, quote, the OLCC has shown no tangible harm that would flow to them or to the public if the current system of over 20 years' existence is allowed to remain in place while this controversy proceeds to final determination. The Commission, also at the urging of the distributors, has suggested that regulatory supervision of the new central warehouses would create a large fiscal impact to the state. Although this bill will be the subject of debate in the Ways and Means Committee if you look upon it favorably, suffice it to say that we believe the agency has chosen theoretical maximums with little regard to reality to inflate the fiscal report. And of course, the agency's last session fiscal analysis mentions nothing about efficiencies that would be created by the central warehouses, permitting auditors to audit a few central warehouses as opposed to many retailers, and totally ignores the trade-off of the thousands of jobs that will be preserved and created as a result of the passage of this bill. It also fails to mention that more wine will likely be sold, resulting in more tax revenues for the state. Mr. Chairman, late in breaking news, I was also, before this hearing began, authorized by Mr. Jarman of the Oregon Wine Growers Association to let you know that the Wine Growers Association is now in support of this bill. And I believe he is still here, and you can address any further questions to him. I want to thank you for your time and attention that you have given not this matter, not only this session, but last session. And I ask that you favorably consider Senate Bill 1501 and move it to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. I'm available to answer any questions you may have at any point.
Mr. Oxley.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Gary Oxley, Oxley & Associates, appearing before you this afternoon on behalf of Fred Meyer and Safeway Stores. Both are licensees of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Fred Meyer operates approximately 80 stores in Oregon, and Safeway operates approximately 99 stores. Combined, they employ approximately 25,000 Oregonians in the state. Based upon the lengthy tutorial you were just given by my colleague, Mr. DiLorenzo, I will make my comments very, very brief. Fred Meyer and Safeway both support 1501. We encourage you to pass it on to the Ways and Means Committee for further consideration.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association, and I will also be brief. And on behalf of our 300 retailer locations in the state of Oregon, we also support Senate Bill 1501, which authorizes central warehousing and will ultimately afford our customers savings with wine in our stores. And so with that, Mr. Chair, we would also ask that you pass this bill to Ways and Means, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Miller, I have a question for you, because you're representing, in essence, the co-op.
Yes.
How, one of the bills that perplexed me, one of the provisions said that the central warehouse, the owner would have to retain possession, title of the wine all the way through and distribute it. Say, for example, you had Gallo that delivered 100 cases of wine to your central warehouse, you know, splitting into 10 or different amounts going to different ones. How would you control that? making sure that, you know, this store's boxes went to them and not to this other one, and all on the same, all looking the same. How do you do that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I suspect you're referring to Section 5 dealing with the cooperative language. It still has the 10-member threshold as a regular retail establishment. So, mm-hmm. you know, we represent the corporate entities, but we also built this particular and worked with Mr. DiLorenzo to allow Unified Grocers, for example, to be able to centrally warehouse and distribute to the independent stores. So I guess your question is how within a Unified Grocers?
I understand how Fred Meyer's or Safeway or Grocery Outlets would do it. I mean, they're managing their own product. They bought it. It's in their warehouse. They're going to move it among their stores. I have a little more trouble figuring out how you do that with the independent guys where, you know, okay, you know, XYZ store buys 3 cases and, you know, ST store buys 10 cases and they all look the same.
Mr. Chairman, it would still be regulated with the license with the cooperative. So Unified Grocers would be the central warehouse. And they, and in essence, they would be acting as the same as a Safeway or Fred Meyer, distributing to those independent stores.
The language says that they would have a ownership interest in each of the entities, and do they have an ownership interest in each of the all of them?
Within the cooperative, there's an ownership interest.
Mr. Chair, if I can elucidate.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how that works. I was reading the bill, I was kind of like, I don't know how this works.
Okay. For the record, John DiLorenzo, I worked with Chuck Taylor at Legislative Council on this section when the grocers came to us and wanted a section that would accommodate central warehousing by cooperatives. And we considered your question, how would the cooperative segregate, you know, as it receives the wine that is destined for various of its members. We didn't have a problem with the language regarding title because every member has an interest in the cooperative, and the cooperative would have title in the wine, and the wine then could be segregated administratively at the co-op level for destination to individual members. We thought we would leave that open, though, because the OLCC has fairly significant rulemaking authority generally. And once the statute passes, the OLCC would have further rulemaking authority to work directly with the cooperatives and sit down with them, figure out what system works best, and design a rule that would accommodate it. And so we did not want to dictate to the cooperatives exactly how they would administer that function. We thought we would leave it open. There is no question that the OLCC has fairly broad rulemaking authority within any arena in which they're given statutory authority. So we thought we would just leave it at that.
Be blunt, once the tax was paid, I'm not sure I care.
And that's probably
Mr. Chairman, if I may, just one final comment on this. I mean, we requested this because from an industry perspective, we wanted everybody to be created equally. And I know originally John brought this forward as a grocery outlet issue, and I understand that, but we also wanted it to apply across all the grocery stores, whether it's a chain or it's an independent store. And so we worked to try to work this in so there wasn't a competitive advantage among stores that we were all able to centrally warehouse.
One other question while you're up here I want you to answer, because it's going to come up from others, and that's, does this maintain a level playing field? I know some others have expressed the concern that those who are able to participate in the central warehouse will be able to market the product cheaper than others.
Senator Beyer, members of the committee, John DiLorenzo, I have had a number of conversations with some other smaller chains and larger chains that you may hear from today who are concerned about the 10-store threshold for maintaining central warehouses. My response has been, first of all, no matter how many stores you have, you can use your current floor space or storage facilities at any of your stores to ship wine from store A to store B. Secondly, it is my understanding that Unified does business with many of the parties, or will do business with many of the parties who will appear before you to join their co-op if they would like to utilize the co-op method provided in Section 5. Some of the parties have still expressed a desire to be able to have central warehouses with less than 10 stores on their own. My response was that was a suggestion made by the OLCC. We have no position on that. This bill, when it goes to Ways and Means, will have to have an amendment because the amendment will provide where the tax will be paid. It is my understanding that one of the OLCC's concerns is finding a way to make sure that wine shipped from out-of-state producers is shipped in a way in which the tax can be collected. We are willing to be responsible for paying for the tax at the central warehouse. We'll need an amendment for that. If the other parties who are going to testify can convince the committee that they should drop the 10-store threshold to zero or to one or to whatever, we'll have no position on that. We're fine with that. We never wanted a threshold for central warehouses to begin with. And so we would be fully supportive of that and are more than willing to work with any of the other grocers who we did not know about before, at least did not know about their concerns, as the bill progresses.
Senator Jarrett?
Actually, my question was about 10-store threshold, so I just got an answer. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, we would support that as well.
Any other questions for this panel? Senator Starr?
Other than the fact that the relating clause is too narrow, why wouldn't you do products beyond wine and include beer?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, two reasons. First of all, we already have a real big bill here. so we don't want to push our luck. Secondly, I think that's a discussion maybe for later, although I can tell you that there are many in the grocery industry who feel that with respect to shipment of beer, this is an area in which distributors do deliver value added because the price per unit is so low. Quite often, it is economically more feasible for a distributor to distribute the beer store by store by store. That is not the case for wine. So, again, we enjoy working with distributors when and paying them for services rendered. What we don't want to do is pay them to move wine from each store just because they happen to enjoy a favored position.
Mr. Chair, it's basically a warehousing issue. I mean, the distributors have the warehouse capability and the price per unit is lower and those kind of things. Appreciate the answer. Thank you.
Other questions? John, I'm not sure I understand the issue correctly, but do a wholesaler or manufacturer, if they're selling into a warehouse or a store in Oregon, do they have to sell to everybody for the same price?
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding currently that that is the case.
And this bill does not change that?
This bill does not change any of those rules whatsoever.
Okay. More questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Atkinson, Senator Atkinson, excuse me.
I just wanted to take a minute and introduce the audience and the dais to my job shadow who drove all the way up from Southern Oregon University today. He is the president of the College Latino Association. I think I might have got those words messed up, but he is the student body president of that. Cesar Ramirez is up here today as we are trying to convince him and Willamette Law School to come to a favorable agreement and include him in some big, massive scholarships. So if Willamette University is listening, that's why he's my job shadow today, no pressure. But Ms. Ramirez is sitting here, and he's absolutely shell-shocked that I would walk him into the Capitol for his first minute and put him on a dais. So
welcome. Okay, Mr. Romaine, let's see. Klein, Steve Johnson. Who have I missed? Did I get everybody? And Mr. Chris Gerard also. Well, come on. There's a chair that we can pull up there. It'd be wonderful. There you go. Come on up.
Mr. Chair, do you want me to go first?
Okay. And go ahead, Paul.
Okay. All right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I represent the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association, and we are opposed to Senate Bill 1501. And I know that comes as a shock to you. usually I would start off by my own testimony, but I want to go through a couple of sort of glaring exaggerations that came out earlier. First of all, this seems to be the jobs session. So if you mention the word jobs, that means you should vote for the bill. And so what I heard was there's 1,000 new jobs coming up in this situation if you allow this bill to go forward. Well, first of all, if you go to Grocery Outlet's website, which is an interesting website, they're headquartered in Berkeley. And what they have in their entire operation is approximately 100 employees. They have over 150 stores, operator agreements with independent business people in 6 western states. In addition, you should understand that what the OLCC is asking the grocery outlet to do is have beer and wine delivered the same way they do it currently in Washington State, which is directly from a distributor or a winery to an individual store. They have at least as many stores in Washington State as they do in Oregon, and they have built very new stores within the last few years, we know, at least in the Seattle area. The reason the stores get built is because the market is there for the kind of goods that they provide, which basically are low-cost goods. It has absolutely nothing to do with this bill. Grocery Outlet, if they lose the lawsuit and lose this bill, will still continue to operate. They'll operate the way they operate in Washington State, and they will be very prosperous. That's one. Second of all, again, Mr. DiLorenzo alluded to warehouses being responsible for the growth. And again, that's not the case in Washington State. There was a little misconception about how distributors got involved in this matter in the first place. And that came because of a law change in 2007. In 2005, there was a U.S. Supreme Court case that authorized, in effect, direct shipping to a consumer from an out-of-state winery if you allow an in-state winery to do so. We felt, and most of the industry felt, that that could be and would be expanded by the courts to groceries also. Since we allowed in-state wineries to ship directly, we had to allow out-of-state wineries to ship directly. There's a provision in the bill that said do not ship to a central warehouse. We sent out an email to all of our clients, that's the Romaine Group, sent out an email to all of our clients saying, make sure you're not shipping to a central warehouse. This is what the bill says. At which point, we had people call and say, what about Grocery Outlet? So we simply called OLCC to say, what about Grocery Outlet? And they said, whoops, and that's how we got started. There was another statement, actually last session, a big deal about it, this session a statement on it, that somehow we don't want people to be able to move product from one store to another because we want them to pay us to move product from one store to another. Number one, we are not allowed to move product from one store to another. We can't do it. We have no permission from the OLCC to do it. That's number one. Number two, even if we could do it, no store would pay us to do it. They've already bought the wine if it needs to be moved to another store. And I'm sure somebody has moved stuff at the request of a retailer from one store to another, a few cases here and there. We would do it. But we cannot do it. Now, we thought that that was a good idea. And it came out of last session, that they should be able to move for inventory purposes. So we actually talked with the Fred Meyer and Safeway representative, and actually submitted to the Liquor Control Commission a proposed rule change, which we understand is up in April, which will allow a limited quantity of product to be moved from one store to another, as long as there's tracking involved. And again, it's a limited quantity. And we understand there is no opposition to that rule, and there's no concern by the OLCC staff, and we think it would help everybody in the business. Because frankly, if the product is not sold, under the old system, the current system, we deliver to the store, they keep discounting the product until it's sold. We can't change it, take it away. The quicker the product moves, the more we sell. It's in our best interest to have them sell the product. We want them to be able to move it around, and so we submitted that proposed change. We think it's a great idea. We thank the grocers for bringing it to our attention, and we applaud them for working with us on the proposed rule change. The three-tier system is not mythical. It's been modified a lot. The three-tier system basically means that there are really three kinds of entities in the business. There's the manufacturer, which is the brewery or winery. There's the wholesaler, and then there's the retailer. Those are the three. In Oregon, we've always had really a two-tier system because we allow manufacturers to wholesale their own product, and in fact, we allow manufacturers to wholesale other people's products. Breweries can get a wholesale license. Wineries can get a wholesale license. Winery can be its own wholesaler. Gallo had its own wholesaler here for a while. Anheuser-Busch currently does. It's, you know, and they're part of our association. The grocery outlet case is in court. It was argued November 8th. I actually moved to expedite the argument, and Mr. DiLorenzo opposed expedition of the argument. The court set the matter for November 8th. I think the urgency is, I'm not sure the hearing went all that well for Grocery Outlet, but we argued the case. It is a very serious case, and it we will hopefully see at some point. We don't know, by the way, just as a sidebar, there's another bill about getting more Court of Appeals judges. Please pass it. I've got another case that I argued July 14, and I haven't seen the result yet. So, but it should be here. And there is an injunction, frankly, in, about the OLCC taking away the privilege that Grocery Outlet has that will not lift until the appeals process is done. And so you're going to have time in 2013 to basically look at this. Let me tell you what the bill was about. The original bill that came in was simply about Grocery Outlet has a problem, and they couldn't get support for that. So what they did was they started expanding it to get it to a critical mass to get some support. But really what the bill is about is the concept of quantity discount. It's not about central warehouse. What quantity discount is giving a, in effect, a better price for buying larger quantities of product. Simple concepts used in a lot of different stuff. We can't use that with beer or wine. We are prohibited by law from doing quantity discounts. We're not necessarily opposed to doing it with wine. There is a lot of practical considerations and policy considerations you need to take into account. But that's what this thing is about.
Where in the bill does it do that? That's a question I asked Mr. DiLorenzo before.
Mr. Chair, in the bill, by setting up a central warehouse, I was going to get to that, by setting up a central warehouse where, in effect, somebody can go outside the state and buy product and have a large quantity ship in, the only reason you would do that, and I think the grocers were pretty candid in their testimony, is to try and get a better price. That's what this is all about.
But wouldn't the, as I understand it, and I guess I'll ask OLCC when they come up, if you're selling into, if Gallo is selling into Oregon, they have to sell it to everybody at the same price?
Mr. Chair, you only have to sell for a 14-day period. In other words, you have to hold your price for a 14-day period. In effect, that was designed to give the marketplace a chance to buy the product. So what we do is we have a price list at the distributor, and we have to hold the price of that product for 14 days. But let me tell you what happens if you take away. Right now we have what's called a blended margin. We We deliver to all types of entities around the state. We deliver to the little mom and pop. We deliver to the restaurants. We deliver to Costco. Believe me, delivery to Costco is a lot easier than delivering to a little mom and pop wine shop. It's much easier to pull up a truck and pull off a few pallets of wine than it is to deliver a couple of bottles to a wine shop. It's also much less expensive per unit. But Costco and that little wine shop buy the product at the same price from us. And that's because of you, or not you, back in 1934, when the law came into effect, it basically said that we cannot offer discounts or any kind of favoritism to anybody. So really what you're doing with this kind of bill is anybody who can set up some kind of warehouse to get a larger quantity shipped in from out of state somewhere will get a pricing advantage over those who can't. We're the ones in state who have to sell to everybody at the same price. Our price then has to go up to everybody who's left. So it goes up to the restaurants, it goes up to the small stores, it goes up to anybody who doesn't have, in effect, a warehouse. So you're setting up a class system that you have never had before. I'm not saying that's a real bad idea. What I'm saying is this is far more complicated than simply allowing somebody to store their own wine. It's something you may want to discuss, but it's not something you can do in isolation, which is what the proponents of this bill want you to do. From a tax collection standpoint, again, collecting taxes is, right now distributors pay 97% of the wine tax, in-state distributors. That's where the wine tax is paid. This bill, as currently written, in effect forces you to go out of state to collect whatever would come in as far as a wine tax. Assuming you say we will have, and that greatly increases your cost, your audit costs. We get audited. We're supposed to be audited once a year. It ends up being about once every 2.5 years or something. But we get audited, and if there's a discrepancy, we pay the tax. In addition, if you set up a situation where the tax is paid here, you've now, by the retailer, even in warehouse situations, especially if you go down to fewer and fewer numbers to put together a co-op, now you're talking about considerably more points of collection for that tax, which again increases the cost. What I'm trying to say to you is that, one other point, the emergency clause. The only emergency in this bill is the fact that the court may come down with a decision, and some people don't want that decision before this bill, don't want that decision to come down before they change the law. What I'm trying to say, and I don't know if I'm doing it in a very articulate fashion or not, is that this is a very complex area where many concepts intermingle. This is not free enterprise because you didn't set it up as free enterprise. You, not you up there, but your predecessors didn't set it up as free enterprise. It was set up as a regulated system with certain things put into place. Are the reasons still valid? Well, let's have a discussion about it. But you can't do one part without affecting the other part. And that's really the key to it. What does quantity discount do to, in effect, the small stores? What does it do to the price of product at a restaurant? Those are all very valid issues. You have a, we know that we're going to be discussing in 2013, and during this interim extensively, privatization. Washington State passed an initiative dealing with privatization. By the way, that initiative is in court. March 2nd's the argument, and it could be thrown out. There's a possibility because there's a single subject issue. But assuming that Washington stays with privatization, which we believe they will, they'll come out with some form of it, then you're going to have 2013 to discuss not only do we privatize distilled spirits, but how do we deliver those distilled spirits, and what's the best way to deliver it? How do we protect our in-state industries? Does one thing lead to another so that we will have problems if we tweak over here? It's a complex area that you shouldn't even be thinking about during a 30-day legislative session. It has fiscal issues. This is not an isolated issue that you can say, rifle shot, we're going to get it done. You can tell by the number of people that are interested in it, and frankly, the commotion that it involves, and by the way, you're welcome for the entertainment. But what we would urge you to do is to consider this, talk about it, bring us all in. We're not adverse to anything. We just want to make sure that you have a holistic situation. With this bill, the one who gets hurt the most, the ones who get hurt, are the small stores who can't take advantage of it, the restaurants, and your in-state distributors who truly do have jobs at stake. Not some mythical jobs that have absolutely nothing to do with this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Pyatt, my name is Erez Klein. I'm the regional wine buyer for Whole Foods Market in the Pacific Northwest region. We currently operate 7 stores in Oregon, and we take great pride in serving the community here. I appreciate the opportunity to share our concerns about Bill 1501. There's a really important conversation for the legislature to have about the OLCC regulatory structure and state control of alcohol sales, and it's one we really do welcome. However, SB 1501 is a piecemeal approach that changes one piece of a larger regulatory system to make large grocery companies and co-ops winners and smaller companies losers. For example, Fred Meyer or Safeway would be allowed to negotiate products, prices for products, pushing for volume discounts, and smaller companies and independent shops would have to pay a higher price for the exact same product. And it's not because one sells more or less. It's because the smaller companies will still be operating under the current existing system instead of the new system that you're being asked to establish. Whole Foods Market can and does compete every day with larger grocers in the free marketplace of food, and that inherently gives bigger players some advantages. But unlike food sales, the state regulates wine, and all those selling wines have to play by specific rules. This bill gives those with more than 10 or more stores, centralized warehouses, or a co-op relationship a structural advantage that will deliver between 5 and 10% discounts by opting out of the new rules they'd like you to create. Current regulations require everyone to buy wine from a distributor for the same price, no matter how much wine they sell. The only alternative is to buy individually from every single manufacturer. That's thousands of manufacturers, and that cost is prohibitive. Under SB 1501, larger companies, for example, opt out of these regulations just because they're large, not because of how much they sell, how well they negotiate. The rest of us, however, must still work within the existing regulatory system, which will get more expensive since many larger players will be opting out. If we all have access to negotiate volume discount pricing from wholesalers, that's a free marketplace, and that's not what what SB 1501 offers. Because regulatory changes take place immediately, those with centralized warehouse or co-ops relationships already in place will have a significant advantage. Two newer distributors in Oregon shared with me that they had to lease their business space for 6 months prior to being granted a license to distribute. And that doesn't include the time it takes to find a facility, or if you're going to go the co-op route, to form a new co-op, finding a physical location, leasing it, applying for a license, and finally going into operation. The 6 to 18 months this would likely take is more than enough time to lose an existing customer base to a competitor. And this would happen just because of a change in one portion of the law. We compete with everyone that sells wine in our market area, from a high-end Oregon Pinot at $100 or more to modest $2 and change wines available at nearly every grocer in the state, including ours. The regulated market we operate within today already has small profit margins. If the state, through this bill, gives a structural advantage to some over others, the state will be deciding who can sell wine profitably and who cannot. Any regulatory structure change should be in the context of the state's overall regulatory role in alcohol sales. It should create a truly free marketplace accessible to everyone willing to compete and should give adequate time to allow businesses to meet that new framework. The barriers that that would need to be removed or amended in SB 1501 would be no threshold to the number of licensed premises in Section 4, no emergency clause, giving everyone time to adapt to the new regulatory changes, we would suggest July of 2013. And lastly, allowing all the existing wholesalers currently in the state to also offer tiered pricing. SB 1501 regrettably does not meet those criteria at this time. We are willing to work with all the players to find a proper holistic solution that leaves us with a level playing field for all to be competitive. Chair Byers, members of the committee, thank you very much for your consideration. I'm happy to answer any questions.
I'm curious. You're the wine buyer for Whole Foods. You only buy for the 7 Oregon stores?
I also buy for 7 Washington stores, and eventually I'll be buying for stores in Alberta, Canada as well.
So when you're making that purchase, do you buy just from the Oregon distributors or separate wines?
At this time, we have to buy for all our Oregon stores, buy exclusively from Oregon distributors or directly from Oregon wineries. And the same will be true in Washington, except they buy from Washington distributors or Washington wineries. We don't buy from Oregon wineries at this time.
Sir?
I'm Steve Johnson. I'm the wine and beverage manager for Market of Choice. We're a small grocery store chain based in Eugene. We have 8 stores in the state of Oregon. And I'm largely opposed to this because of the 10-store fresh threshold. We would like to centrally warehouse wine ourselves, frankly. This would not allow us to do so, and we would be put at a competitive disadvantage with larger retailers who would be allowed to do so. There is a slight misconception that I've heard here today. We have currently a permission from the OLCC to buy directly from out-of-state wineries who have an Oregon sales permit. Every time we do, I send a form copy to the OLCC so they can track the taxes and a copy of the invoice. And so that is a possibility under today's regulatory framework.
Who pays the tax in that situation?
The winery does.
The winery pays it. Out-of-state winery?
The out-of-state winery does. And
are you suggesting if the threshold was 5, you would be supportive of the bill?
I would rather see it 0, frankly.
0?
Or one.
But, I mean, I think anyone who is willing to pay the $1,000 and provide the regulatory framework that the OLCC needs to make sure the taxes are collected should have the access to it so that nobody's disadvantaged
by size. Where do you buy most of your wine from now?
Largely from Oregon wineries and distributors. In our particular situation, we sell mostly import wine and Oregon wine. Non-Oregon, we
import as in from outside the United States.
Outside the United States,
and you buy that mainly through distributors.
Through distributors, in fact,
you've
you
got
have
a pretty
to buy
broad.
That.
You've got a pretty broad selection of wine in your stores.
Yes.
How do you know that?
It's based in Eugene.
Yeah, and that's what our customers buy. Yeah. And yes, we do sell California and Washington wine, but it's not the majority of what we sell.
We're selling the quality stuff. Senator Starr.
Great question to the last two folks that have testified. So the bill has been crafted in a way that allows for a cooperative. You know, you could join a cooperative to have the benefits of central warehousing. Is that not an option that would be appealing to either Whole Foods or to your
It would not be particularly appealing to me, frankly. Largely, why we want a central warehouse is to find things, and I don't mind buying from an Oregon distributor, but things that would be a special value that we could make exclusive to us that are not private labels. You know, so it involves some research, some legwork, and then we would have that and bring in 3 or 4 pallets or however much and sell it.
This is from their website yesterday, and it simply says, partnering for success.
independent grocery retailers come in all sizes, but they have one thing in common. They're owned by individuals and families, not by large national or multinational public companies. Whole Foods Market is a relatively large multinational public company. So I don't believe that we would be qualified to be members, and I don't know that our board of directors would feel that would be proper to have a cooperative voting on that, things that would affect our business. We would probably have to go our own.
Okay, thank you. Sir?
Microphone. Chair Meyer, Co-Chair Atkinson. My name is Chris Gerard, and I'm president of Plaid Pantries. I'm also chairman of the Oregon Neighborhood Store Association. It's interesting, the co-op is a very unusual business organization. They just aren't around anymore. They used to be. And if this bill was about having an exception, unusual organization do something that apparently they've been doing for 20 years, it sounds like there's something that could be worked out with OLCC or something, but looks like it took lawyers to, I guess you haven't worked that out yet. But a co-op is completely impractical for a corporate operation or a small store. You know, there's 3,000 of our kind of stores in Oregon, and most of them are owned by, you know, one store owned by a family. There's the Korean American grocers that are kind of loosely coordinated, but it's just not a practical organization for today for our business. We buy through a large warehouse. We're the biggest customer in the particular warehouse of this big company that's in Portland. But this bill, I guess I would like to buy direct from manufacturers and save some money. But it prohibits our business structure from doing the exact same thing through our warehouse.
Don't you have more than 10 stores?
We have 106.
So wouldn't you qualify under this?
Pardon?
Wouldn't you qualify under this if you chose to?
To deliver? Well, warehousing.
A central warehouse? If you chose to have one?
Chair Beyer, we like to be profitable. warehousing takes scale. This is a bill for co-ops and for very, very, very large companies that have the scale. That's it on the face. It's not for small and medium-sized businesses. In fact, our company had a warehouse at one time, and 22 years ago, that was the first thing I got rid of. You can't make money in wholesale distribution unless you have scale, which brings us to the three-tier system. Whether you like it or not, we didn't wake up this morning and say, oh my goodness, we have a three-tier system. It's been there since Prohibition. And what we have is a structure of manufacturers, wholesalers, retailers, and the retailers retail and wholesalers wholesale, and they can keep it in the manufacturers, and maybe there's exceptions in there, but this is a large exception when you open the door to have large retailers go directly to manufacturers and cut out that middle step with the distributors. It clearly, you know, again, this started out with Grocery Outlet, but you see that all the major grocers are here, and we also know that the large grocery stores would like to sell distilled spirits, and this is opening up, and it was referred to before, it's pulling on a string here. There's a big thing called privatization and the whole three-tier system, and there's pluses and minuses. And today's not when we're going to argue privatization or three-tier system. But the fact is that system has been there for decades. And so we have Oregon's economy built on the manufacturers, wholesalers, and retailers. And if we're going to change that, I agree with what Paul Romaine said, it's a much, much bigger discussion. Senator Starr brought up a good point. How is wine different? Why not beer? And, of course, we heard Grocery Outlet. Yeah, they'd like to do that too. So that's probably Senate Bill 1502. So we don't want to change what we've got until we really look at it, because there are people that have made huge investments, a lot of family businesses. They've made long-term business plans on our current system. If we're going to change it, and we know the privatization discussion is coming, let's open the whole thing up and talk about it. This is
just one little piece of it, and I don't think the best way to approach such a big change is to do it piece by piece like this. This has much wider implications. Thank you.
Senator Gerard.
Yeah, you brought up something that just kind of challenged my brain here a little bit. My dad was in the grocery business, and the question is, you said that you don't warehouse. So I'm trying to figure out how you cannot warehouse and have even the small amount of groceries delivered to these smaller stores. I mean, they're not going out and buying C&H sugar from C&H sugar.
We have meetings with our warehouse company. It's Core-Mark. It's an international company. They're all over the United States. And I am so happy that they are in that business, because wholesaling and Paul Romaine's clients, it's a skinny, skinny margin. It's a brutal business. And that's why you need the scale to make it work. You need really big numbers of sales to make that work.
But if you're buying it from a wholesaler, say like, well, my dad belonged to United Grocers.
Yes.
I mean, if you're buying it from a wholesaler, then it seems to me you qualify under this provision. Unless I'm reading it wrong, I don't understand that.
Senator Beyer, Chair Beyer, Senator Gerard, I qualify to be unprofitable. We would not be profitable without our distributors. We need our distributors for our formula to work. And the small stores especially need the distributors.
Okay. And so it's, sorry, not to interrupt, but
no, sir.
The 10-store limitation then doesn't apply to you as it does the gentleman next to you. It's just the fact that economies of scale are such that you don't feel you'll be profitable under this resolution.
Chair Beyer, Senator Gerard, we have proven that.
Yeah.
If I may, you reminded me of another point. This significantly weakens the distributor network. And so it's kind of a double whammy on the non-largest stores. So the large stores have much more buying power. What this bill does is give them a further advantage so they can be bigger and get more buying power, and it's going to hurt the small businesses.
Senator Toronto, if I can, I think the question is one I was trying to get at earlier, is that they wanted to do it working with the distributor. They would have to have them, I think, buy on their behalf, say, 10 cases from Gallo, and they would have to be in the warehouse, and they'd have to maintain their 10 cases separate from the other people's 10 cases. And they would have to have the ownership of it from delivery to the warehouse all the way through.
Yeah, but the co-op would have the same problem.
Well, that's the point I was getting at. I think it's not a single ownership. I think each one of the members of the co-op would be, who are going to be the retailer, would have to own that product at the point where the winemaker distributor, if that's the wrong term, distributes the store.
I think
probably nobody knows the answer to that.
Mr. Chair, if I might, if I could chime in on that, because really what happens is Core-Mart is a distributor like a beer and wine distributor. They just don't have beer and wine. They could apply to the Liquor Control Commission and get a beer and wine distribution license and then bring in wine. Core-Mart could do that. But again, it's the same thing as Molitas Beverage or Columbia Distributing or anybody else out there. At that point, they are a beer and wine distributor. They have a wholesale license. So that's the model that Mr. Gerard works with. He does not want to, what he's saying is for him to set up a co-op, all of his products now, except for the beer and wine, come through a Core-Mart, which is a distributor that doesn't carry beer and wine. I believe that's the case.
Senator Atkinson. Were you done, Senator Durant?
No, I'm done.
Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. I have several comments and then leading to a couple of questions. And hopefully I can arrange these in the right. I think this is a very interesting discussion. The thing that has fascinated me about the discussion from this panel and the previous panel is not one has mentioned the consumer. I find that just to be shocking. Mm-hmm. Because what we're really talking about here is who makes the money. Does distributors make all the cash? Do the grocery chains make all the money? My MBA training is always when people compete, prices usually typically don't go up, they actually go down. And I actually, on behalf of the consumer, I'm fascinated by this. I live in a place in Oregon where the fastest growing business is a liquor store 300 yards over the Oregon border. honest to God. Honest to God. It is a racket. And I am fascinated. I go down there, they got a brand new parking lot. Hill, California, they got their own off ramp there. They got big billboards in Oregon leading right down there. And you go down there and buy, I'm told, the same product for $15 that in Oregon cost $45. Oh, I know you have a puzzled look. I bought this product. I can show you, Mr. Romaine. And it goes all the way down the line. So there is a, let's say it, this isn't for this bill, but there is a liquor arbitrage where I live. Fascinating business. Very interesting. I also, from my business training, know about mythical jobs and the difference between setting up individual stores under LLCs for liability protection versus under full corporate protection for both liability and tax purposes. But I do know that if there's an individual member LLC store, however that is arranged, if it's a mom and pop or whomever, and if it has any kind of franchise agreements for branding, marketing, or as in the case of retail, there was a fantastic company, a former client of mine called BrandSource, that would share marketing co-op dollars. Yes, co-ops are still very much alive in advertising. That those jobs, those companies still hired people. It wasn't a myth. I mean, yeah, they maybe not get their direct pay stub from Berkeley, California, but they still paid people. So that one's a little bit of a stretch for me. Now, why am I interested in this? I think the system's a little goofy. I got to tell you, I live where there's liquor arbitrage, right? I mean, sorry. I got involved in this case, and this is my bill, because the government changed the word. Let me repeat that. Because the government gave their word to a business and then changed their word. Is it pending? Yes. It was thrown out by the commission. The commission, which I got sideways with and marched off to the governor and recently and had my chat with the governor about a commission getting out of line of the governor. Yes, they have thrown a big fit over this bill. But the administrative law judge found in favor, not of the commission, the administrative pending law judge found in favor of the business. So I think there's a very interesting precedent that might be happening. Mr. Grard, I don't know you, but I know your career, and I'm actually an admirer of yours. You don't know this.
Uh-oh.
No, it's good. But in your testimony on the second page, you have something that came up in an argument that I find this is good, it's consistent. And I can't for the life of me remember, but it was your friend of yours and friend of mine sitting behind you who asked us to do a rifle shot for Plaid Pantry in the legislature. And I believe, I forget the bill, it was several sessions ago, but we had a legislative fix. And it happens in business a lot. Sometimes you get an abnormality in the law, you have unintended consequences. And I remember when, I forget the bill, Richard, but the bill, I do remember if you really want to kill a bill, you say it's going to have unintended consequences. Now isn't the time. We need to study it. We need to create a task force. So I'm a little, you know, just saying. So when we say 30-day session and it's a rush job, this bill's been out here for about 18 months. 18 months, Senator Johnson and I have been working on this. A lot of press and bad feelings last session over this particular bill. So this isn't new. Now, oh, a couple more quick comments. About the entertainment value of this, you have to recognize that those of us up here don't even make gas money. So for us, it's really not all that entertaining to see very well-paid advocates on both sides duke it out. Because, I mean, you know, we're actually here not for your paychecks. We're actually here for the consumer. That's who we're supposed to represent. Now, let's get down to business for just a second. You're right. We do have a class system. I think I have for the life of me can't understand why this is good public policy not to have you all buy and compete. So Senator Starr just asked a question. If you take the limit from 10 down to 0 and give you the freedom to buy as you wish, would that allow you to be supportive of the bill? I think that would be good public policy. The advocates or the proponents of the legislation have said they'd be delighted to work with you. That's great. So if you'd like to do that, that'd be fine. In just a second, I'm almost done. I'm actually on your side here on this. But I tell me somehow how it's good for the consumer to allow the distributor to make all the profit. Just convince me that that's good for the consumer.
Jump in.
Chair Beyer, Senator Atkinson. You had a number of different points there, but I'll, since you approach this one directly, if you allow the big to get bigger and you increase the marginality of the smaller operators, costs are going to go up in the overall system. And that's the discussion that's going to happen when we get to privatization. But to allow competition, if competition is good, to change a structure that's in place that reduces competition, especially among the smaller operators, and at the end they're all operating on the margin, competition goes down, prices, then there's going to be pricing power. So right now the way the system's set up, it's not very efficient for Fred Meyer because they've got the scale and the volume to go do something. But Fred Meyer doesn't sell most of the wine in the state of Oregon. It's sold by a whole lot of other smaller businesses. And I would say that, to answer your question, the price, if I can come back to your arbitrage deal, that's another misconception that I hope in the broader discussion comes up when the P word comes up. And that is, the reason there's arbitrage is because we tax alcohol very high in Oregon. And that it's not a sign of inefficiency, and I've looked at the OLCC system. I can't operate as efficiently as they operate. It's amazing. The reason the price is so different is that we tax the heck out of distilled spirits in this state. And so the consumer looks at it and says, well, I'm getting ripped off because I can buy it cheaper in California or somewhere else. Well, yeah, the tax isn't as much. So I wanted to respond to your arbitrage. That's why that's going on. Same with cigarettes. Right now there's a huge arbitrage of Washingtonians flocking over to Oregon for their smokes. It's a big tax difference.
More? Thank you very much. Oh, excuse me. Senator Starr?
So thank you. Seems like one of the big arguments against it is just that whole issue of the price, potential price differential, the grocery outlets, the Fred Meyer's, the Safeway's, being able to negotiate much better prices. Mr. Romain talked about a 14-day price hold, basically. But, if you're Fred Meyer, you can wait for the price to renegotiate and go down, I guess, and buy 100 cases or whatever the number is. Would it make sense, or would it? We can write the law however we want. We write the law that says that they have to charge the exact same rate to everybody that's buying wine in a particular state, and extend the 14-day time period to some period that's broader or bigger or longer, to make it so that there's a level playing field?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, interesting concept, probably almost impossible to enforce, because the people that are selling the stuff are now out of state. And it's very difficult to say to somebody in California or Washington or New York, actually the lion's share comes from New York, that you will sell at the same price to whomever wants it for whatever period of time. That's easy to enforce within the state. It's very difficult outside of the state. That's number one. Number two is a lot of these places their deals, they're going to ship in directly if they can ship in enough quantity to make it worthwhile. Right now, they have the ability to ship direct to any store. Any single store can pick up stuff. They just can't warehouse it. So the product could come in, but it's not economical for them to do so. it's not worth their while to ship to seven different Whole Foods. It'd be better for them to ship to one Whole Foods location, if you know, to use Whole Foods as an example, because he's sitting right next to me. There's a lot of different things you can discuss, the pros and cons of whether or not you want to do it. I just want to, there's a couple of interesting statistics. You would think that California, with their entire wine selection down there, they have a huge number of wineries. You would think that the amount of wine available on the shelf in California would actually be greater than that in, say, Washington State or Oregon. We did a study a few years ago, Washington State distributors, some of my guys distribute in Washington State, to distribute, and what they found was the Kroger, which is Fred Meyer, basically, with their stores in Washington and California, have about 40% fewer SKUs, in other words, fewer facings than, or different kinds of product than Washington. Safeway is about 20% fewer. And those states have volume buying, things like that, which promote, in effect, buying large quantities of fewer product. Senator Atkinson talked about the consumer on all this. And frankly, we all go to Costco. I love Costco, even though I know it's a great operation. It's a wonderful place to go, as in, you know, most of the retail community are good. But you can have any deodorant you want as long as you want the one that's there. And it's sort of like the Henry Ford theory of buying. We're going to have, you can have any color you want of this Model T as long as you want black. What you do is, the more you promote sort of the volume stuff, the more you encourage sort of less selection, if you would. And the consumer, we believe, does not benefit in that situation. Distributors, again, I want to go back to our discussion of quantity discounts. It costs us more money to deliver to the little guy than the big guy. That's a policy decision you may want to make. Maybe that's something we should, take into account. Maybe we should have separate pricing and allow us. But what this bill does, again, is put your in-state distributor at a competitive disadvantage versus everybody else. And I'm not sure you really want to do that. Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Oops, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, sorry. You asked me about the number 10, number of limits. I don't think I can use Core-Mark under this bill under any circumstances, because Core-Mark is separate. I don't own them. In fact, by state law, my company and none of my directors can have any investment whatsoever in one of the other tiers of the system. And so it's not an option for me to, I'm sure Core-Mark would like to have the business of wine and beer and distilled spirits. But under this bill, even though our combined volume is a pretty large number for a small company, we can't buy through Core-Mark under this bill.
Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Colleagues, I would ask your indulgence. The chair of the OLCC, who gets paid even less than we do, is taking time off to be here.
I doubt that's true.
She does. is here, and I would like to let her give her a chance to testify. And that's all I have, and it's not my intent, given the hour, that we're going to work the bill, nor we're missing two members.
I appreciate that. And with me is Executive Director Steve Farrow and Tom Irwin. They are not planning on speaking. They're just accompanying. If I have any questions. With their props. For the record, my name is Cass Sterling-Lapata. I am the chair of the OLCC. Thank you for indulging us in this late evening. I wanted to touch on, thank you, a little bit about the three-tier model, and I'm not going to address a huge amount of time, but Oregon adopted the model of alcohol regulation in order to prevent the recurrence of conditions that had existed prior to prohibition, as we know. These abuses of the system resulted in part from manufacturer control of retail outlets, which led to a lack of competition in the marketplace. This also resulted in unsafe business practices to maximize sales, causing public safety concerns such as overconsumption. A wholesale distributor tier was specifically added to reduce these abuses between the two. The three-tier system helps ensure a level playing field for businesses within each tier and reduces the potential for dominance by one group of licensees over another. It does so by defining the privileges and requirements for licensees in each tier and by prohibiting licensees in one tier from holding an interest in a license of a separate tier, which you just heard about. Now, SB 1501 may complicate the wine tax collection issues. The current structure assesses tax liability at the distributor-wholesaler level. There are currently 193 wholesale malt beverage, wine, and warehouse licensees in Oregon who are responsible for submitting reports and ultimately remitting wine taxes. OLCC currently has 2.5 FTE who process these reports monthly, and the process involves manually reconciling sales reports from distributors with reports from retailers. Now, we heard briefly about this earlier, that the law currently allows some retail licensees to receive wine directly from out-of-state wineries who hold a self-distribution permit. The amount of wine imported into the state via this route is limited because the retailer must sell the wine at the location where it is received. They cannot distribute the wine to other locations for resale. Additionally, retailers who elect to receive wine through self-distribution must hold a license endorsement for this activity and must report on the amounts they receive from out of state. OLCC staff reconcile these reports, as I said earlier. Now, when the product is not received from a licensed distributor, the tax reporting and liability shifts to the out-of-state manufacturer. Tax revenue would not increase, just the work volume involved in the collection of the revenue. However, this process may result in decreased tax revenue as we will be dealing with unknown out-of-state entities, which may choose to stop reporting the sales instead of remitting taxes.
Would that change if we change, could that be addressed, I should say, if we change the law to require the centralized warehouse to pay the tax?
I assume
what that would cause then would they would just the wholesaler would, or they would negotiate a difference in price?
Chair Beyer, I think it gets closer to our concern, except for you're still going to have more central warehouses. The auditing issues are still going to be there as far as the number of FTE, and you're still going to have the issues of the retail licensees acting as wholesalers against in opposition of the three-tier.
That's a philosophic argument. I mean, it's sort of a so what?
Sure. Sure, I think it gets closer to our concern, but I don't think it quite meets it.
Could that work though? If you required, I think you require it now, don't you? If they're a winery's delivering directly, don't they have to pay the tax now? If they're delivering it to a store?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Atkinson, committee members, they go through a distributor. So the distributor is the collection point for us.
But I thought there was a part of the law allows direct delivery by a out-of-state manufacturer to a retailer.
Yes.
And in that case, doesn't the manufacturer pay the tax?
But that's extremely small.
The process is there, but the use is small. Is that what you're saying?
Right. And the use is small.
So what would be the hurdle if we just shifted that and say if you're a centralized warehouse, you're responsible for paying the tax? That would limit the number, it seems like.
Dramatically.
It'd be just like saying you're a distributor. I mean, functionally, wouldn't it?
Mr. Chair, committee members, that would relieve some of it. However, you can still ship to each of the retail points. So even if you have a central warehouse and you have 30 stores throughout the state, each of them could also be shipped to directly by that winery that's outside
the state.
But
that's the case now.
A distributor actually distributes to each of those retail locations.
But I thought the law was changed. I thought Mr. Romaine was talking about that in order to allow Oregon wineries to ship directly to stores, we had to allow out-of-state wineries to ship directly to retailers. So it seems like we have that process in place, and you're not changing anything by that. The question that I'm asking is that aside, if we made this change and said
you can have a central warehouse, but if you're a central warehouse, you have to function for tax payment purposes just like a distributor. In other words, you pay the tax at the time you receive the wine.
Mr. Chair, committee members, that requires a special holding. And I
what's the terminology?
I'm sorry.
Wine self-distribution.
That's right. Wine self-distribution. So the retail location has to have a special license, as it were, to go ahead and actually do that distribution.
And that's a requirement of statute?
Yes. Chair Beyer, we have attached to my testimony our two workflow charts. And the first one is the current distribution system, and the one behind it is what looks as Senate Bill 1501 combined with our current system.
Debbie could also explain this in detail.
Never been up here before.
Mr. Chair, we have one of our financial folks here.
To be very clear, I think I said it. My major interest in this from a legislative perspective is to make sure the tax gets paid.
Right, currently. And she would be the person you want to talk to.
Right.
I'm Debbie Amsbury. I'm the manager for the collection of privileged tax. Your question was if we had the tax collected at the central warehouse, mm-hmm. that would work. But you still leave it open to the out-of-state winery shipping directly to the retailers. You leave
right.
it open. Currently, they can do that, but they can only receive what they can sell at their location.
Right.
So,
I don't think anybody has suggested we should change that.
But I believe it opens it up that they can receive and ship among themselves.
Yes, that would be if you have a, I think the way it's been stated is if you had, if the law was changed, if you had a central warehouse and chose to use that, then you could receive it, and what I was asking, pay the tax, and then you could ship it among your stores, not to anybody else, but among your stores.
But I believe
which doesn't have anything to do with the, if you're a retailer, if you're Plaid Pantries and you want to take a direct delivery, you could do that if you wanted to.
My understanding of the bill is that it opens it up to the retailers being able to receive more than what they can sell at their location.
If they use the central warehouse. Unless I misunderstand it, that was mine.
Getting a shaking head in the background.
Hmm?
Getting a shaking head in the background.
So I think it's answer, though.
Bill, can I ask, how many people are here from OLCC?
We want to make sure you get it exactly right.
You have the chairman, board, who's not paid.
No, hold on. Madam Chairman,
yes.
How many people are here from the OLCC?
Seven people.
Seven employees of OLCC are here on this bill.
Six.
Including
me. Right.
Go ahead.
It's
going to take all of them.
I wanted to ensure that we were able to have someone on hand to answer some of the questions that you may have.
Do you have concerns with this bill?
Do I have concerns?
Yeah.
Well, like...
No, it's a yes or no. Do you have concerns with the bill?
Yeah, I do.
Are you for or against the bill?
Right now, our stance is neutral.
Excuse me. I'm Donna Vandal. I'm also with the OLCC. I think what we were referring to is that we understand that Section 2 of the bill allows an O licensee themselves, not through a central warehouse, to also distribute to affiliated entities. So because that O licensee that doesn't have a central warehouse can also distribute to affiliated entities, it would also be bringing in more product than if it had to sell it only at the location that it was brought in.
I see what you're saying.
So that's another complication.
And in that case, it would be the out-of-state winery that had to pay the tax.
Yeah, which is true under current law, but now it's limited. Again, they only receive what they can sell at that location. So this would increase the quantities that would go to the non-central warehouse locations.
So that goes to the right of a grocery store or whatever, to be able to move product among its stores. Okay.
Now, as far as the fiscal impact of SB 1501,
Section 2 is only related to OLCC's ability to collect and ensure compliance with that tax, the wine tax. By this statute, if out-of-state wine manufacturers ship to retailers, then two things happen. One, Oregon retailers will have to report the shipments they receive. This will be more than double the amount of paper filings that will be received each month by OLCC's 2.5 FTE financial staff. And two, the tax liability will shift, again, to out-of-state manufacturers and become a workload issue related to compliance and collecting. OLCC estimates that we will need 5.5 new FTE to deal with the proposed changes, 3.5 FTE in financial services to handle a more than doubling in the amount of tax filings, 1 FTE in regulatory to collect owed tax that is not paid. New tax reporters have the highest rate of noncompliance, and we estimate that the number of entities reporting and paying tax will jump from 193 to over 1,000. And 1 FTE is a licensed investigator to set up the central warehouse license, investigate business relationships, initiate rulemaking, and administer the new process. This position is proposed as temporary and will be eliminated after 2013. And in sum, by allowing off-premises retailers and central warehouses to distribute wine to other locations, this bill will likely increase the quantities of wine imported via self-distribution from out-of-state wineries. This will require additional OLCC staff to receive, reconcile, and audit tax reports from many more entities. And second, the out-of-state entity, rather than the in-state retailer, is responsible for paying the tax. Third, because the quantities of alcohol received by retailers for distribution would be very large, any reduction...
Let me ask you a question before you go on there. And I'm suddenly thinking of the gentleman from Market of Choice who says what he gets now when they come in from out-of-state is a, I assume it's an invoice or something, which they send to OLCC, and so you've got a pretty good record of what's coming into the state and whether the tax was paid or not.
Ideally.
So it's unclear to me how much auditing, I'm not sure how you audit that other than you've already got the invoice and you would know from that how much tax they were supposed to pay, and it seems like you could do that all from your Portland office.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, that is exactly what happens, but I think the process is that what we do is we reconcile what we get from Whole Foods with what we get from each of the wineries that they receive from. And so we multiply that by the, I think there's about 1,600 out-of-state wineries that are authorized to ship into Oregon. So each of them is submitting a report about how much
they're... But you're doing that now.
And they're reconciling, right.
So why would you think this would increase that?
Because right now, the vast majority, 97% of the wine that comes in from out of state comes through a central distributor without going directly to the retail stores. So the distributor pays the tax.
Uh-huh.
In this case,
so you think
they're going to bypass the distributor. So instead of having 193 entities collect 97% of the tax, you're going to have many more people paying the tax
Think if they did this, though, that the Safeways and Albertsons would do the central warehouse so you would have just a handful of more? I don't think it would increase your... I can't imagine that for the smaller outlets you're going to get more going directly to a store. In fact, it would seem like you would get fewer because it would be easier to send it through a central. And I suspect that most of them wouldn't change at all. It wouldn't make sense for the argument that the gentleman from Plaid Pantry made. Why would you change using your distributor for a small amount of volume? May change. I think the best argument that I've heard was because of the volume purchasing, it may change the competitive landscape a little bit and disadvantage the smaller stores. But I don't think that's an OLCC issue, is it?
As far as?
The competitive advantage.
What do you mean as an OLCC issue?
I mean, your issue is control and collecting the tax. Thank you very much. and that really doesn't change in terms of if Safeway sells more than Plaid Pantries because they sell it cheaper.
Our concern right now would be the tax collection piece. there's any other further questions?
Yeah, I'm trying to work through in my mind your how many more agents, and I'm having a little trouble with that, with your assumptions about what would happen under the scenario. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I'm sorry for derailing you.
Actually, I came to the close. That's all I have.
I was going to make a comment. Mr. Chair, committee members, the comments that we raised with regards to FTE or additional folks deals with the bill as is it proposed. When you talk about changing the bill to where the tax will be paid at Central Warehouse or something else, that may change, but we would need to go ahead and have time to look at it to do the evaluation. But at this point, based upon what the bill is...
I've got a revenue impact that says it's indeterminate, which in legislative parlance means, oops, there's no revenue impact.
That's not ours.
Huh?
The revenue impact
is... I was telling you the way it's usually read. It says if it's indeterminate, we don't worry about it.
Fiscal impact or revenue?
Because we were going to make some changes.
The revenue impact for this measure is minimal.
Minimal.
The revenue or the fiscal?
The revenue is minimal.
Right.
Oh, I meant fiscal.
The fiscal is indeterminate. I just want to clarify, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Conceivably, the revenue impact could be larger. You might end up selling more wine.
I don't know.
I'm sorry, Senator Gerard, you had a question?
No, actually, the gentleman answered it.
Okay.
Had to do with if we change the bill for the Central Warehouse, like you were suggesting, which I think is a good idea, I think that would lower the fiscal dramatically from what would they were kind of hinting it might be.
Okay. More?
That's it. I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, you don't have to look that way anymore.
We ran out of members.
More? Is there anybody else who feels the need to testify today?
I think I've worn out my poor job shadow.
Seeing none, we will close the public hearing. Yes, I was going to get there. I was closing the public hearing on this bill, and we will carry over everything that we didn't move out today until Tuesday. Any other thing else for the good of the order? We are adjourned. Thank you very much.